His name was Kevin. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Carrington. How are you?
I don't know why I'm singing you a theme song, but...
I like it.
Do you like it? Okay.
Yes.
I shall sing it to you always then.
His name was Kevin. He did a podcast. I don't know.
I like it. But you know what? That's all
song.
You need.
It's
my song. How about my royalties, man?
You are likely to be eaten.
You are likely to be eaten by a group. If this predicament seems particularly cruel, consider whose fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory. You are likely to be eaten by a group. If this predicament seems particularly cruel, consider whose fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory.
Tell me something interesting.
Well, I can tell you that we played a weird game this time.
We did. All right. So for those of you just tuning in, this is Eaten by a Gru, a podcast where we play Infocom games.
Except
the last episode, we played a game that I found so distasteful that I needed to wash the taste out of my mouth for a while. So this time we played a non-Infocom game, Thimbleweed Park.
So different. Well, I mean, still an adventure game, but holy moly, this was, basically it was like playing Maniac Mansion. So it was kind of like playing one of the games that killed off Infocom. We really have gone into the weeds in this episode.
Yes, indeed. The Thimbleweeds. First of all, I want to, have you ever played this type of adventure? Did you ever play Maniac Mansion or King's Quest or any of those?
I played them. I love them. The Monkey Island series, Maniac Mansion, the Indiana Jones ones. I love them very much. So this was a very familiar world for me.
See, this is not so much for me. I was going to say I'd never done it, but I mean, I had fiddled with King's Quest when it was new. I have played a little bit of Maniac Mansion because they did a new version of it for the iPhone, which I bought, I don't know, a year or two ago, and I did some of that.
A little? You didn't do the whole thing? You didn't get hooked?
I found it. I found the small phone interface was just not the right interface for it.
I can see that. Can see that. Although the clicking would probably be nice instead of you having to go with the mouse, be able to just touch with your finger.
It was hard to read on my little phone, and I don't know. So it's not that I didn't enjoy the game, but it was having trouble drawing me in just because of the platform.
I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Yeah. So anyway, so I had never really played this type of game, although I was nominally familiar with them.
Nominally. Ooh, I know a big word too. Marmalade.
Wow. Nominal marmalade. Nominal marmalade.
That could be our band.
Yeah.
We are Nominal Marmalade. Hello, Chicago. So this was made by people who did Maniac Mansion, I think, correct?
Yes. Yes, these guys had worked at Lucasfilm
or LucasArts, I guess, or LucasArts Games.
Right.
Who in this game? What do they refer it as? Mucus phlegm.
Mucus phlegm.
in Thimbleweed Park, the in-game developer wants to go work at Mucus phlegm.
Right. These guys have been, I mean, there's in jokes, you can kind of tell who these people are just from the game. They worked at Lucasfilm and worked on games like Ball Blazer and the Eidolon, and then, you know, wrote some books and stuff. In fact, this was kind of funny. One of the people involved, a guy named David Fox, and there's a library in the game, and in the library there are literally thousands of books, and you can kind of look at the covers. And one of them I stumbled upon was Computer Animation Primer by David Fox, and I was like, that's funny, that's a real book. So so I went to my library of Atari books, and I grabbed it, and I did a selfie of me holding my book, and I tweeted it to David Fox. And he responded, and he's like, oh, and There's a Ball Blazer poster behind you in the picture, which indeed there was, and was completely unintentional. I just, it was just, the poster happened to be behind me when I took the selfie. So anyway, it was a very mucus phlegm sort of picture, I guess.
As sometimes they all are.
Yes, it happens.
So, being not as familiar with this sort of game, like not having played all of Maniac Mansion, oh, it looks like a lot of these guys worked on Maniac Mansion too, it probably means a lot of the in-jokes were maybe lost on you, or you wouldn't have been digging them as much or something?
I felt like...
Because there's a lot of them in this game.
Like, I felt like there were several things where I'm just like, wow, I bet this would be more interesting if I had played Maniac Mansion.
Right.
For instance, right. There's a grandfather clock that a character makes reference to. It's like, it's in better resolution than it used to be or something like that. I'm like, okay, well, the old mansion had a clock in it.
Right. And because you could probably pick up stuff like that. Like, you can get that it's a reference, but it's not going to have that, you know, kind of tickle you humor that an in-joke or a quip that's a contextual reference would
that's normally true. Have.
Like Ransom, one of the characters, has a hamster in the microwave, which is right out of, like, commenting on Maniac Mansion. And that wouldn't be really a comment if you didn't know that that was a controversial thing in Maniac Mansion.
I didn't know that at all. Yeah. However, there was posters up on the wall for Lucasfilm games and stuff, and I saw those and thought it was clever. So, and you know, and unlike the Sherlock game we played last week, where I felt like you needed to already be familiar with Sherlock for this game to be good, in this, I didn't feel like in any way I needed to be familiar with Maniac Mansion in order for this game to stand on its own.
Okay, then that's a good point, because yeah, you had said that about Sherlock. Like, you felt like if you weren't already a big Holmesian nerd or something, the game would be, if not lost in you, just less appealing. It's kind of making the assumption you're coming in as a fanboy, which, of course, as we all remember from last episode, I totally was. So. And I came into this game already a fanboy of the LucasArts games. So, and from that standpoint, I could say this gave me everything I would want in essentially a modern Maniac Mansion. I just loved it. I mean, oh my goodness, this was just like one of the best of those games, just with better graphics and a much, you know, bigger, richer story and a larger world. I thought it was totally amazing.
I enjoyed it too. It was a fun game. I'm glad we played it.
Yeah. So I guess we should talk a little bit about what the game is about. Essentially, set some background here, I guess, for people who have not played it yet. So it's set in 1987, which was the year that Maniac Mansion came out. And it's also, I don't think it's coincidence that it comes out in 2017. So it's the 30-year anniversary. So that's a nice round number anniversary. So it kind of makes sense they'd be looking back that far if you're kind of doing something in the style of that game. And it very much is exactly, as we were saying, exactly in the style of something like Maniac Mansion, where it's a point and click adventure that's in kind of a third person perspective. You're looking at the scene from the side, but you're controlling characters that will move, kind of walk around in the scene. And the scene is all done graphically, all on the top part of the screen, and on the bottom part there are words that you can click on. And so rather than something like an Infocom game where you're typing sentences, this assumes maybe you're partially illiterate and you can just click on words. And so you like click on the word open, and then you'll click on a door and your character will go open the door. So this is the Idiocracy version of an Infocom game, I guess. But I actually do really like the control in general. I like this sort of thing. I prefer the King's Quest style that do not have those words in the bottom. It's just click on things and it should figure out from context what you want to do, or drag things to combine them. I like that better than this. I think I was turned off a little bit this sort of interface back when I used to do it not with a mouse but with a joystick. And when you're kind of moving a cursor by joystick to aim at things, it's much slower than with a modern one.
Terrible.
Exactly. So with a modern one, building use the mouse, much, much better because I first played these games, you know, flying my cursor around with a joystick, and it's much more difficult. So this gets rid of that completely. And it's another reason why I thought playing it on maybe not a phone, but an iPad or a tablet of some sort might be even nicer. Be able to just immediately click on a word or something would be good. So, but I do like this sort of interface in general. And I thought the graphics and the atmosphere were amazing. Oh my gosh, I just love this 8-bit style. It's not 8-bit, other than kind of some stuff at the end, which we'll talk about after the spoiler fence. But it's in that 8-bit graphical style. So it looks like kind of a higher resolution, widescreen version of a late 80s game. And I thought the art was completely fantastic. I love the scenes and the atmosphere and the art.
Me too. The art is fun. The graphic style is a lot of fun. It was very good. And as far as the interface, at some level, I found it was having the verbs, the list of nine verbs basically that you can use on the screen made it. I don't want to say easier, but it was just like puzzles were different. Because, like, you know what? There's only a certain number of ways to manipulate things and only a certain number of things. And so just like when I was completely stuck, it's like, okay, let's try some random combinations, or, you know, some strange combinations of things. Like it felt like more manageable than sometimes when you're stuck in an Infocom puzzle and it's just like, wow, I have no idea. Because there might be some verb that you didn't even know the game could handle, like, you know, unscrew or something that's not going to happen here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'll never get in that position, which you can get with text adventures where you're playing the search for the synonym game, where it's like, oh, you want me not to ski down the hill, you want me to slalom down the hill or whatever. Here, simply use the hill. It's like, because basically, you're right, there's essentially the grid of nine words, and the three interaction verbs are what push, pull, and use. So you can either push a thing, you can pull a thing, or everything else is just do the thing with the thing that you would do if it was the thing you were using. And then there's like look at and talk to and pick up and three more. I don't remember what they are, open or something. So in that sense, it can make it a little more approachable. Though I did find that some of the puzzles are challenging. This isn't a baby game. It took me quite a while to finish it. I did like the puzzles very much.
Mm-hmm. Me too. I found they were mostly manageable. So I thought maybe a couple of puzzles felt a little uneven to me, but I had to cheat very little. I felt it was easier than your...
What do you mean uneven puzzles?
Some of them, I couldn't figure out some of them, so they were they were harder than the rest, and therefore
totally.
It was uneven.
I get it. I absolutely, there are some that are easier and then a couple that I completely got stuck on. I did find that overall I would say the puzzles are doable, and if you get stuck, you basically just have to wait a bit and it might come to you. The most of them, in fact I think all of them, are I would categorize as fair, in that like once you find out what the solution is, it seems relatively logical or sensible, at least once you do find out what I don't remember a puzzle where I thought, oh, that's just ridiculous, I never could have solved that. So
I have one in that category which we can talk about later after the spoiler chance.
I do too, but I don't recall it offhand. I don't think I wrote anything down. You also can't, as far as I know, you can't die, or else I'm just amazing at this game, and you can't get the game into an unwinnable state. So I think that's pretty cool.
And I like that at the near the beginning of the game, a character flat out tells you that.
Right. Doesn't he say, like, if this was like a Zach McCracken game or whatever, you'd be dead already?
You're right. Yeah. Yeah. At one point I was doing something that seemed ridiculously dangerous, and the character said to me, like, if this were a Lucasfilm game, I'd be dead by now. No, but actually at one point she says, I don't remember the exact wording, but she says, like, directly, she's just like, games from back in those days used to be too hard, and you could get things in an unwinnable state, and that's not going to happen to you here, you know. And it's like, okay, great, and that was kind of liberating. Like, okay, I'm not going to screw something up super bad.
Well, if I was making a very difficult game, I would absolutely have a character lie to you and say that.
Nice, yeah, yeah, and a couple times when things are squidgy character says to you, it would be a good job to save the game right now. A good idea. I mean, squidgy, yeah.
Totally squidgy. Yeah. Oh, we haven't mentioned that you control, here's the big thing, you control multiple characters in this. Like, unlike something like Zork, where you've got your avatar that you're seeing, you know, through your point of view. Now, there are some Infocom games where you control robots or whatever, that we haven't played those yet. But in this, there are essentially five characters, and you could be controlling any one of them at a time, and you switch back and forth between them. So there was, who are the characters? There's Agent Ray and her partner, Reyes. There's Franklin, who would be like the friendly, charming ghost, in a sense. There's Dolores, who I liked very much, the math and computer nerd. And who's the fifth?
Ransom.
Ransom the insult clown, yes. Who, right. Holy cow, did I think I would hate Ransom. When I first looked at this game, I thought, that is the character I'm not going to like. I wouldn't like that kind of jokester in real life. Turns out, great character, and I really enjoyed him in the game. I thought he was one of the better characters, in fact. I was very surprised at that.
Yeah, I am too. I feel like the same way. I was like, oh, this guy's going to be a just blowhard that's going to be terrible to have to interact with. And no, he ended up being fun and almost sweet in a way.
Although very funny that he continuously swears but gets bleeped. So, which is funny. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, so there's five characters, and you can choose which, well, for the most part, you can choose which ones you're playing. And you can make them, you have to make them work together.
Because it's not, so we explain, it's not that you, it's like you're playing a game and you just pick the avatar and you play the whole game as one or the other. It's that they're all interacting in this world at the same time. And so you're switching back. And when you switch from one to the other, you're kind of pausing the one character and you're taking over the other. So you are controlling at various times all five of them. And like you're saying, they sometimes you have to use more than one to solve a puzzle. They'll interact together.
Yes. Yeah. And you have to switch between them. And while one is doing one part of the puzzle, the other has to do another part of the puzzle. And basically they need to work together, which I liked, but I found it strange. And I don't know, I was overthinking this perhaps, but there are times when you are making a character do things and there's no reason why they would know to do this
thing. I totally know what you're saying, because I felt that a few times too, where I was doing a thing because another character needed it. And so my character's like, I'm just going to move this over here. And so therefore you can jump on it or something. And it kind of doesn't make sense from the character who you're making do this other thing. They're just acting as this puppet for the first character, but they're all acting as a puppet for me. So ha.
Right. Exactly. Anyway, so in kind of in a meta way, I thought that was odd.
Oh, as if meta thinking would come into this game.
Right.
Wait till the other side of Spoiler Friends, kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought I wouldn't like that as much. And a lot of games where you play more than one character, that's another thing that will put me off, because I can find it kind of confusing. And then so you're playing the game, you feel like, oh, I'm now completely stuck. And it's because you've got to switch over to character C or whatever and then do something. Whereas in this, I found it was very good at giving you kind of direction on what to do, because each character has their own like individual goals, and they actually have like a list, like a to-do list that you can open up at any time. So you can see what you're working on, what you've done, what you haven't done, and what each character needs to do. And so I found that really gave me a lot of help to keep the game moving. I wouldn't just be walking around with a character who in a sense had nothing to do in a given chapter. I would know, no, it's this other character I got to do stuff for. Because we should mention, the game is sort of divided into a bunch of chapters, and it's around chapter 4 or 5, you start getting all the characters thrown together and it gets a little more complicated. But I never found that aspect incredibly frustrating the way I was worried it was going to be.
Right. And I didn't have to keep extensive notes about things, because they sort of do it for you automatically. I mean, this character literally has a list. Like, here's the five things I need to do to progress in the game.
Yep.
Like, great.
And they all have their own inventory, but there's not an inventory limit. Like, you play a lot of games, you're like, okay, now what do? I can't hold all the stuff I need to hold. That didn't become an issue in this game. But each character does have their own individual inventory, though.
Yes. And I thought it was interesting, an interesting choice, that there was drop command. So,
oh yeah, it's really just
you can't really get into it. You're not really going to get into a state so much where you can't complete something because you don't have the right thing. Because once you have a thing, you always have the thing, you know. And there are trash cans where you can throw things away, and then but it won't let you misuse that. So, So I appreciated
and
that.
And I like that kind of thing. I don't see that as kind of making a baby version of the game. It's just getting rid of a frustration that just doesn't add to a game. It's like, we don't need that. Let's just go. Let's just remove those little frustrations that just kind of annoy everybody when they play them.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I feel like they really, in doing a modern version of these old games, they really did manage to iron out some of the frustrations with these games.
Yep. Like there's there's a map, like an overall world map, that kind of also acts as a fast travel system. Although you do still have to wait and watch while the teeny tiny little character really quickly runs along the winding road, which gets a little old by the end because you do a lot. But it's basically a loading screen as you're moving to the next section, and it's a fairly quick one. So I think it's a very effective use of a loading screen. There's an elevator in part of the game as well, which is kind of the same thing. As you go up the elevator, you're waiting as it dings through each of the floors, but that's because this is also acting as a loading screen as it loads on the next level. And I thought both were very effectively done and remarkably quick for loading up a whole other part of the game. It just, you know, here you go. I never found that frustrating.
I felt like I spent so much time in that elevator. I mean, because it's an actual, you know, you watch the character go from one side of town to the other. And I mean, I started to really feel frustrated with watching them walk and trying to get from point A to point B and just traipsing across town or going up and down the elevator just 50 times. And I wish there was faster ways to get around. And I figured out that map thing, but only one of your five people can have the map at a time. So,
I never found it super frustrating, though. I thought it would be more so. The elevator, weirdly, maybe the elevator a little more than the world map. Because on the world map, you might even spend as much time if the person's traversing the world, but since they look like they're moving so fast as they whip along that road, it feels like they're really doing their best. Whereas in the elevator, it's more like ding, ding, ding. And so it might be the same amount of real world time in the journey of the elevator. It feels longer because you're going through slowly through these floors. And yet still, neither of them really got to the point where they were bothering me. I just figured I'd just mention it though.
Okay.
Apparently.
I saw a tweet a couple days ago. I follow the Thimbleweed Park people on Twitter. There was someone was actually stuck on an elevator for an hour, and so he brought out his laptop and was playing the game.
So, very good.
Yeah, you could be doubly stuck on an elevator in that situation.
Looking through my notes here, a lot of notes about humor, like a lot of things came up where I'm like, oh, that's really funny. Again, mostly in jokes. Like if you're a fan of these games and the LucasArts games, like Maniac Mansion or Monkey Island kind of things, a lot of in jokes and a lot of references and quips. And I really liked it. It's not a humor game, like a straight ahead funny game, the way say Monkey Island is, but it does have lots of quips, like and neat lines and things, so it keeps that like snarky kind of comments, and I enjoyed that, and I found those things funny. But it's interesting how that humor does kind of contrast with the ghost town backdrop. The setting itself is in a sense very dour, and the game is a lot about the like investigation of like a murder and like. There's a person, a ghost in it who was murdered at the hotel. And so there's a lot of dark stuff in the background, a lot of dark stuff in the theme and the plot. And yet it's lightened by the amount of quips and levity brought through the interactions and the spoken stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And we talked about the characters you play, but there's also a lot of characters you don't play. And I enjoyed most of them. They were just a variety of interesting people in the town, the non-playable characters. And some of them are quite just quirky and fun, and I thought it was just fun. I don't want to say too much to spoil, but there was just clever people around the town. Not too many, but enough.
I found the Trons very funny. There was the Printertron 3000 and the Fingertron 3000 and the Facetron 3000 and the Bloodtron 3000. I found all of them very, very funny.
Yes. Yeah. It's good. How long did it take you to finish this game?
About 45 minutes. By which I mean about, oh, I gotta say, I didn't keep track, but if I was to guess, because 15 hours, like a long time, a long time, much longer than I would have thought.
Okay, so every time you save the game or whatever, it tells you how long that you've been playing.
I guess I could look at that then.
So yeah, if you can open up, load up the game, and then just you'll have at least, even if you didn't save, there'll be an auto save, and it'll say, you know, how long you were playing the game.
Yep, I am.
I'm curious to see how
connecting
that
over to my my computer. I played on a different computer, but I can connect.
First of all, I'm super curious to find out how much time it actually took you based on your guess of 15 hours.
Why? Do you think my guess is wrong?
I don't know. I don't just...
Because it felt like a long time. That's why I'm guessing 15 hours. Like it felt like it much felt longer than...
So what I'm about to say is not a diss of this game at all. But
it's a diss of me.
This is the first... I don't play a lot of modern games. I really don't. This is the first game I've played that's on Steam, and the first game I played that has achievements, and, you know, achievement unlocked, this happened or that happened, and the first game I played where it really keeps track of how long you've played it. And so as I'm playing, I ultimately finish this game after 26 hours of time, but as I was playing it, you know, oh, I've been playing this game for 10 hours, for 15 hours, for 22 hours, I started feeling anxious and maybe like guilty about the time playing this game. It's just like, wow, that's 26 hours. I could have been, you know, practicing piano or doing interviews with, you know, for the Antic podcast or, you know, whatever. It's just like kind of I was getting like a FOMO. I didn't like the fact that the game was tracking how long I was playing it, basically, because I'm just like, wow, it made it just too real for me. I don't know.
Well, I can tell you that I am amazingly good. I was a little over 16 hours. So
wow,
I was right. All bow before Carrington.
Very good. Yeah.
And you know what the thing is? And also 15 was a total guess. Like, so I was like, yeah, it seemed like a lot of time. Let's call it 15 hours. So it's actually just a complete coincidence. But yeah, there you go. So it does take, you know, 15 to 20 hours to play this game, which I think is a very good value for the cost of the game.
Or 26 if you're stupid like me.
Well, no, but I've played a lot. The thing is, though, I have a lot of... How much better are you at Infocom games now that we've played a bunch of them? Same thing here. Like, I played a lot of these exact... This game, I played basically this exact game 10 times. So I think you just get kind of quicker at it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, definitely good value for the money. I was one of the people, I assume you were too, who backed this on Kickstarter, and I think it was $20 or something to do that. So yeah, I mean, good value for the what it costs. Let's see, this was a Kickstarter project, and the game just came out very recently, certainly the most recent, most modern game that we've played. By decades. Came out just a couple of months ago, earlier this year. The Kickstarter goal was $375,000, and
they beat that by a lot, though, didn't they? I think
they did. Ultimately, they received $626,000 from more than 15,000 backers to bring this game to life.
And I think it's been fairly, in fact, I think very well reviewed. So they got more money than they needed, and they had a well reviewed game. So hopefully, that means they'll do another one. Because I would absolutely return to the fold and play their next game should they make one.
I would too. I think they're planning on it. It's something to do with robots or something. I'm not sure.
Now, would you say, because you've got less experience playing this exact sort of interface of a point and like a point and click game essentially, would you recommend this as a first point and click adventure game?
Yes. I think I would.
Because I thought a lot about that, and I think so too. I think even if I had never played these before, I think I would find it accessible and enjoyable. And in fact, in a lot of ways, maybe people would find it more accessible than having to load up an old one, go back to a King's Quest or a Maniac Mansion,
right.
Which would be slower and you know, smaller resolution resolution, and also a quicker resolution. And so I think. I think I would too. I think like if you're saying I've never played this sort of game, maybe it's not for me. This might actually be the one to start with.
Yeah, and like I said, because they iron out some of the frustrations of the older version of this kind of game, then it certainly makes it more accessible to a modern player.
But then if you play this first, does that make those older ones now less accessible because you won't put up with their nonsense?
I don't know. You said low resolution. You reminded me of something which I don't. I assume this was intentional. I haven't seen this mentioned, but I found it very clever. Is the one of the characters' name is Dolores, which has the words low res
there. Yep.
I just loved it so hard. I love that.
You know what? At the end of the day, yes, because she's like the math and computer nerd. She was my favorite character and probably the most relatable character to a lot of people who would play this game. She was amazing. I had a soft spot for her and her sort of, in a sense, complicated relationship with former Uncle Chuck. And the game was more nuanced in its characters and its characterization and its plot than I would have anticipated for this sort of game. Yeah, there's more to this. It's like the people who made this game have grown up, and it's a slightly more adult worldview in a lot of things, and yet still super fun and super approachable. Like, I still really liked it, and I really liked the humor, but there was just more to it than I would have thought.
I looked up some of the actors because we have actual, you know, voice talent in this game who they read all the, you know, all the this lines and the dialogue and everything. And I looked up some of the characters. The woman who plays Dolores, you know, is a voice talent, and she has done like a ton of stuff with it was weird. I was just saying, it was in her clip thing, it was weird listening to Dolores like extol the virtues of Alaska Airlines
I thought the voice acting was very good.
Universally
I was like, yep, everybody good. I liked it. Nothing stood out as bad. It was a very, very polished game, like super professional. This might have been a Kickstarter thing or whatever, but this was, I thought, grade A quality across the board.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so comparing apples to oranges here.
I like apples.
I like oranges. Normally I kind of look and see how many objects, how many words are in a game, and we compare it to the average for an Infocom game, which it's completely unfair to do this for this game, but I'm going to try to do it anyway. I wrote to the Thimbleweed Park people on Twitter, and I asked them how many rooms are in the game, and
nice.
They didn't know exactly, but he said around 100 unique rooms, which an Infocom game has 81 on average. So, okay, it's about kind of about right for a.
See, I would have guessed. I mean, the number 100, I guess, sounds right, sure. But if you had asked me ahead of time, I would have said this probably has way more locations than a typical Infocom game. My feeling was it was a much larger world than the games we've been playing.
You think that is because you could actually visualize it? I mean, you know, it was right. I mean, it was visualized for you.
Yeah, I guess. Weird. But it really felt like it was a much – not in a good or a bad way. Just I would have guessed that this had, on average, twice the locations of a typical Infocom game.
Right. The average Infocom game has a vocabulary of 976 words. And as far as I can tell, this game has a vocabulary of 18 words.
So Infocom game wins on that one.
Yeah, right. And I asked about objects. told you this was an unfair comparison.
Totally.
The average Infocom game has 44 objects, and the Thimbleweed folks told me they don't know for sure how many objects are in the game, but there are a lot of inventory. I mean, certainly it's hundreds of objects, and which is way more than the 44.
At no point overwhelming, though. At no point did I find the inventory overwhelming, or I'd have so many things that I wasn't sure what I should be focused on or what to do next. So might have a lot of inventory or a lot of objects to interact with, but at no point did it seem overwhelming.
Agreed.
Uh, I think that's all I've got for general stuff. I would just say in general, I found it funny. I liked the plot. I would recommend the game. I'm really glad that I played it. I thought the art and the character and the plot and all of it was interesting and lovely and very well done. Great value for the money. I'm very happy that I played the game. And whether or not you've played this sort of game before, if this sort of game interests you, which as a listener to this podcast, probably it does, I would highly recommend it. I give it a 15 thumbs up or something like that. I'm not sure how thumbs work, but all of them are up and I recommend the game. What say you, Mr. Savitz?
I agree completely. This was a lot of fun. If you're not going to let yourself, you know, feel guilty about investing somewhere between 16 and 26 hours into this game, you should play it. It was fun. Well done. I have 15 more thumbs up from me.
Ooh, that's a lot of thumbs up. So 30 thumbs up from me and my crew. which is a lot of, probably 40% of the thumbs we have.
How many thumbs do Grews have?
They have many thumbs. You can't actually count them.
Because it's always dark.
They have a non-integer number of thumbs. I don't really know. Because it's always dark, yes. And they bite them. So I think we should hop over the spoiler fence because I got things I'd like to talk about that are specifics.
Sure.
That will, as always... completely spoil things for you. So we've reached the spoiler fence. And those of you who are new to the way we podcast, this is the point at which we will start to ruin the game. So you shouldn't go past the spoiler fence with us unless you have played the game or are certain you don't want to, because we are going to talk about the ending. We are going to talk about puzzle solutions. We are going to very immediately spoil things. We don't go gradually into it. It'd be like, we're past the spoiler fence and here's how it ends or here who's died. Like we wreck it right away. If you have played the game, then join us on the other side and we can start to discuss the specifics.
Yes. I feel like if you have not played this game and it interests you even in the least, don't go past the spoiler fence. Instead, go play the game because you will enjoy it.
I really think you shouldn't go past the spoiler fence if you hadn't played this game yet.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is the spoiler fence right here, right now. Stop listening. This is it. Last chance.
I just shut off my mic. I'm afraid. You talked me out of it.
Okay. On the next episode.
That's it. It actually finished. Okay, so before we get to the ending, there were some puzzles. I did look, and it looks like I was stuck for a while on tiny puzzles, but they weren't big deals. Like, I don't have anything that I said seemed unfair or unreasonable. Like, when you're in the hotel and that nobody can leave because the ghost is messing with the doors, it took me, like, an embarrassingly long time to think of the solution. Like, basically just go scare the kid at the fountain and then scare Ray, and that brings the ghost over and frees up the doors. That took me longer than it should have to figure out. Like, it's a really simple thing. And it was like, I just walked around for a while. I don't know why it didn't occur to me, but that's it. So what was the thing that you got stuck on or you thought was unfair or whatever?
Sure. I kept a list.
A list?
I have a list. One of them was just me being stupid. Like, I knew I had to get the banker to give me the check. And so I went to talk to the banker, and I was expecting a new choice of dialogue of just like, hey, I need the original of this check for this reason. And it wasn't there. And then I actually had to look up there's a website that I'll link to in the show notes, which is called Tiny Incremental Hints for Thimbleweed Park, which is great. They're just like little gentle pushes, and I like
that. That's a really good idea.
Yeah. And basically, you have to give the check stub to the banker, and then he gives you what you need. It's like, I had the check stub. I knew to go to the banker, and I just felt stupid for not giving anyone. That was just like me being
especially
dumb.
In this sort of game where, like we said, there's only so many things you can do. You try to use things on other things, and there's only so many combos. So
right. So, but that was kind of a little thing. I could not find the secret meeting. And I thought maybe it had something to do with all the people tromping through the forest at the trailhead, and I just couldn't find it. And then I totally had to cheat to figure out, okay, well, all these people are tromping through the puddle, and then you need to use the nuclear waste to put in the puddle so that their footprints will glow. And okay, all right. That felt fair, although I couldn't get it. The part where you had to use the trophy, I guess it's part of the same thing. You had to use the trophy to get the nuclear waste troubled me because I thought of other ways to do it, and that none of which worked. But you had, there was like one particular object you had to use in order to use as a vessel.
Yeah, basically, because you're using it like a bowl. Basically, you fill it up with nuclear waste.
Right.
That one didn't. Like, I knew I needed this stuff, and I don't know. Maybe it's. I think that exact solution has come up in these sorts of games before, so maybe that's why it occurred to me, because you really only got the one thing, or she's got the one thing in her inventory that's kind of a bowl, and so
right, except for the glass with the fingerprints on it, which was also could be used as a bowl, except they wouldn't let you.
Oh, I guess I didn't think of that.
The fact that the agent's watch fits in the time clock makes, in order to control the time. Right. It makes sense, but I thought it was the jack, the port, the connector thing in the picture of the time clock. I thought it was another tube socket.
Oh, because they're using those Nixie tubes or whatever, right? Okay,
right. Yeah, and I just thought it's another tube socket, so I never would have gotten that. And the last thing was the clown his ransom. Thank you. His missing page, looking for pages of his book.
Oh, okay. When you're putting together the joke book and the one flies off,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to use the trampoline thing. That one gave me pause too, because I kept thinking, am I doing something wrong? Because the page flies off, and then how do I get that? And then how can I reach it? And that's an example of using another character, because it's who pushes the trampoline for him? It's Dolores, I think I used.
Yeah.
But that's an example of somebody else saying, why don't you go do this thing that kind of doesn't help you?
Right. Right. So I had my double problem with that puzzle was, first of all, how did you know the paper was there? I had to be told the paper was, because it's on a pole, the top of a pole, which is off the screen.
Yeah, but I knew you had to get up there. There's something, either somebody says something about, something told me that I needed to be up there.
I mean, okay.
But again, it wasn't that I was looking for the page, but I knew that was a place I could go.
So I didn't, I missed that. And then I just kind of had a problem getting the trampoline to the right place. I felt that the interface of pushing and pulling the trampoline to move it properly were did not work well.
You had to
start on the correct side of the trampoline and push and pull did different things depending on the side you're on. And it was a little sloppy in the interface, I thought. But
I agree.
Ultimately,
yep.
I got it. Yeah.
Yeah. Better than you doing it with a joystick, though. So.
Okay, yes.
So maybe I got a low bar for these things. I really liked, on the other end of it, there was a couple of puzzles I really liked. When Ransom makes the bomb for the door out of the C4 and the little Pez thing, mm-hmm. I thought that was great. I really liked it. And then it blows, but you don't need to blow it up, and the door just falls over. The whole thing I found great. I just really liked it. And I kind of even knew, I'm like, I know it's not going to blow up. And I know the door's it's making me laugh anyway. So I found the whole thing. And that's right. Also, that I remember that scene really standing out to me, because there was a couple of the rooms, essentially, where the art, like the angle of how the scene is shot, in a sense. I just want to take screenshots. It was so beautiful. That's an example of one where it's kind of taking place in two corridors, like it's on an angle, so you can see it's being shot like from the corner of an angle. So most of these games, especially back in the day, if you're in a corridor, it would just be, it's flat because you only have so much resolution. And here instead, you're looking down two intersecting corridors at an angle, and the door's on the one side, and you can hide around the corner because of the bomb on the other. And just so well done, in the same way that in the another one was in the coroner's office, where they're using the bloodtron and stuff, that shot in the foreground are the 2 feet. You're kind of sitting on top of a corpse, as I guess if you were operating the camera, and you're seeing the room, but sticking out in front of you are the feet of a corpse, and just they're just in the foreground, in a sense that you kind of disappear. And I just stuff like that, like the art was so good in this. I just, lots of little bits of whimsy in the art I really liked. But yeah, I liked that C4 plus Pez bomb made me laugh.
Yeah, it was good. And you're expecting it. Oh, I was expecting a big explosion, and instead it was just like a tiny little poof. Like,
and then the door falls.
And then the door falls down anyway. It was clever.
Made me laugh, yeah. Yeah, and I liked all the misspellings of things, office and certain death, C-E-R-T-I-N or whatever. Like, and just
secret meeting.
Yeah, secret meeting, exactly. So I liked all that kind of stuff, and even the stuff from Ransom, who I thought is kind of sophomoric or whatever, but I still liked the character and enjoyed the humor in a way that I thought I would not.
I got a kick out of the Sheriff of Reno and the hotel manager Abu.
Yes. Totally. And again, like I said, all the Trons, the Bloodtron 3000 and the Printertron 3000 and the Pillowtron, of course, the biggie with the ending. We should talk about this ending, but do you have other stuff you want to talk about?
I have a couple of things, frankly, which confused me in the game, and I was hoping maybe you could provide some insight, because
I will.
Of things I'm just like, what's this about? Two things. First of all, maybe this is a Maniac Mansion reference that I didn't get. The guy, Doug, with a shovel, who is digging in the mansion, is just like, he's got a shovel and he's just like digging in the entryway. He's digging in the hallway, like digging holes in a place that's not outside. I didn't understand. I thought it was going to make sense later, but why? What was with that?
I just thought it was funny because he's a guy named Doug.
Didn't understand. I thought maybe it was going to lead to a puzzle where there was something that
remember, I think he's in Monkey Island. Am I right about that?
I don't know.
I'm going to guess that he's from one of the Monkey Island games, but I'm now thinking that's only because there's so much digging in the Monkey Island games. Somebody will write in and tell us. But that would be my guess, but I don't actually have a memory of that.
Okay. And the other thing was there's a part, it's kind of a cut scene, where Ray's blacks out, and then he's watched over. He's like on a table watched over by Agent Ray and the sheriff. And I don't understand how that fits into the story of the game. You know what I'm talking about?
Like the autopsy part?
Yeah, maybe. Ray disappears from the game for a while. He's actually not, you can't actually choose him on the side. And there's this cut scene where it's like all black and white, and he's like laying prone on a table, and the other agent is standing there hovering over him. And then a little while later, he reappears in the game. It's just like, and it says like, I think I blacked out for a while, but I'm okay now. And
because there's the coroner under the sheet is just having the nap,
right?
That's what you're talking about?
No. Now I feel like crazy. Like I imagine this thing. All right. All right. You want to talk about the ending? So let's.
Everybody wants to talk about the ending. Huge fourth wall breaking ending. So basically, the characters find out they're living in the game. They are living in a simulation like adventure game. And so more than one of them have the goal essentially of escaping from it. But particularly Dolores, who wants to, how she puts it, escape the endless cycle of pretend choices, which is like a remarkably philosophic look at these things. Major fourth wall breaking. And also Agent Ray finds the puzzle dependency chart to give it to the developers, mm-hmm. and therefore escapes the game. And then Dolores basically wants to shut down the game, is going to go into the wireframe world, and all that is just like, wow, I didn't see this game going here at all. So I found that very interesting, and I want to kind of talk about the philosophical ramifications of this ending. But first, what was your sort of emotional reaction to the ending? Because this game ends differently than a lot of games would end.
I felt like I knew something was coming. Something in that realm was coming for a couple of reasons. Mostly because we got an email from someone who said he wasn't going to spoil anything. He said there's no spoilers here, but then he said the ending of the game was so meta, and that kind of spoiled it for me. Like, oh, I knew something was coming, you know?
Oh, we got mail from somebody from, was it Peter? I think Peter Fletcher mailed us. That was it. I can say, and I didn't read the email. So sorry, Peter, I've yet to read your email, because in it said, The email began, I haven't played most of the Infocom titles. I've never been able to keep up. Oh, but finally, you're talking about a game I've already finished. And I just immediately shut the email. I'm like, you know what? I'm out.
Yeah, I did the same thing with his email.
I was like, nope, yeah. because I just don't trust. And I was like, it was a big email. I will come back to it later. So I will read that email, but after we record this podcast, because I was too afraid it was going to accidentally contain a spoiler. So I didn't read anything.
I didn't. There was another email that I didn't stop reading soon enough. There's a copy of Blazing Saddles in the game, and Dolores says, "I'm not sure, I love this movie, but I'm not sure how I felt about the ending." And okay. Well, now here's spoilers for Blazing Saddles. Is the main character leaves the movie and watches the end of the movie from the theater.
Right.
So then I was just like, oh well, it's going to be something like Dolores has programmed this game when she got her. She programmed this very game when she got her job at Mucuslam or something like that.
Right.
So I knew it was going to be meta.
But it's super meta.
Yeah. Should we read the two emails we got about this game before we continue?
I like it. I will scroll. Okay.
I'll start with the one that I think that I was talking about before. It's from Josh Malone. He says, "Hi guys, I haven't played Sherlock, but hearing you both talk about it actually does sound fun to me. I read quite a few of the Holmes books and watched various movies and TV shows and found them all enjoyable. Your mention of the importance of the Watson character reminded me of the film Without a Clue, which has the comedic setup of Watson being the genius detective and Holmes a bumbling drunken actor hired by Watson as cover. Highly recommended. From your descriptions and reactions, I suspect a lot of the clues to the puzzles in Sherlock weren't actually in the game, but in the Holmes canon, the beginning puzzle where you must get Sherlock Holmes out of his drug-induced state is a clear case of this. In the novels, Holmes would frequently resort to drugs, cocaine, and opioids, in particular to combat boredom. If the game developer were writing for an audience of Holmes fans, this might not have seemed like a difficult puzzle, but actually more of a warm-up. Okay, so getting to Thimbleweed Park, he says, I'm excited you guys are playing Thimbleweed Park next. I recently finished it, and I'm really anxious to hear what you both think of the game, as it seems to be getting some mixed reactions from folks. Please be sure to mention your history with point-and-click adventures. We've already done that. I personally have very mixed feelings on Thimbleweed Park. On one hand, it was fun to play, very nostalgic for the LucasArts games, and had some good puzzles that were fun to solve. On the other hand, I eventually tired of the in-jokes of the breaking of the game's incredibly flimsy fourth wall, and found the ending to be dissatisfying, almost to the point of regretting the more than 18 hours I spent getting to it. By the end, I thought the game felt unfinished and entirely too meta. But like I said, I did have a lot of fun playing it. I think I only needed one single hit in the game, so it's my least cheaty adventure game completion yet. Basically that one paragraph where he said it was meta kind of what about its meta, you know,
that kind of thing will happen to me too. Just mentioning that there's a twist will make me spot the twist. You don't have to tell me what the twist is. The fact that I know a twist ending is coming, for instance, in a movie, will make me more likely to spot it. So just saying there's a thing to spot can sometimes be a spoiler. It's funny though, talking about that though, that brought to mind Sherlock Jr., the old Buster Keaton movie from 1923 or 1924, I should mention, since we're coming up on the next one, because that's both a Sherlock Holmes type thing and also a like postmodern meta thing, because the projectionist goes into the film. So it kind of combines our last two episodes,
right?
And also Buster Keaton rocks. So there.
Do you want to read Peter Fletcher's email that you had mentioned?
Do I have it? Yeah, I have it. Sure, I'll read it. Let me find it. Peter sent us email. He said, scrolling and talking slowly so he could find it. I found it. Hello, fellow adventurers, writes Peter, whose email I apparently do still have. I've been wanting to write in about some Infocom titles, but I never seemed to complete it in time to contribute much. However, on your one and only non-Infocom episode about Thimbleweed Park, I have finished in time. To be honest, I have always been a bigger fan of point-and-click adventures than I have of text-based ones. I think it has much to do with the point-and-click visual mapping. I also find it easier to think about the puzzles when I see the rooms rather than having to conjure them up in my mind. I will try to do better with my Infocom gaming going forward. Now, on to Thimbleweed Thimbleweed Park. I really cannot express how much I enjoyed playing it. I played all the LucasArts Monkey Island games, as well as the Indiana Jones series way back when, and since the Thimbleweed team is made up of mainly LucasArts veterans, the gameplay is immediately familiar. There are quite a bit of references to their earlier games, which I enjoyed. They may have made a bit too many of those for some people, but I found it clever and fun. As far as the characters are concerned, I like them all. Then he talks about the characters, which we've already talked about. The interplay between the five characters really makes the game fascinating. Each has their own reason for converging on the same goal, though the characters don't necessarily like each other. They do need one another. I did find it a bit odd at first that the characters couldn't speak to the others unless it was at a specific time in the script. As the game progressed, though, I understood that those interactions were not necessary. Since it couldn't happen, it wasn't important. The NPCs are really interesting. The sheriff slash coroner slash hotel manager gives off a distrustful vibe. I always seem to think he's up to something that's counter to your goal. The townspeople as a whole are a bizarre bunch. Leonard, the stoned shop clerk. Chet in his pizza hut, in his pizza suit. I like Chet. Madame Monero in her gypsy wear. George, the postman, and all the others were entertaining to interact with. Well, the hobo sure has bad taste in music. That's all very true. The puzzles were often challenging, but none were unfair. I had many moments where I finally figured something out that made me feel silly for not getting it sooner. Oftentimes, three or more of the characters were needed to solve a puzzle, and it took me time to come to that realization. The character interdependencies made the game more enjoyable to me, but added to my occasional frustration when I got stuck. As for being stuck, I only needed to solicit some outside advice, searching for hints online, a couple of times. The puzzles are very doable if you step away from them for a while. Also, having so many characters that have things to solve allows for bouncing about amongst them. I found it helpful that I could continue on rather than always coming to a dead stop like in so many games of the genre. I like how the game is serialized into parts. It provides a nice breakpoints as well as giving the player feedback on how things are progressing. I can ramble on for hours, blah, 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 and he says, I just really like the game. I found it shocking in a good way. This is the ending stuff. Oh, we're allowed to talk about it. I'm reading this trying to avoid spoilers, but I can spoil away. He says, I don't want to give away anything if you haven't finished it yet. I don't want to talk specifics, but I wasn't prepared for the breaking of the fourth wall when it happened. I found it shocking in a good way, and ultimately, it explains the whole game. The ending made me smile. And thanks for the great podcast. And thanks for the great email, Peter. That was very nice of you. I had avoided that email because it says I finished it and it looked long and I was afraid of the email, so I didn't read it before now. So that is me sight reading your email.
I mean, so I liked the ending. It wasn't what I expected with the Blazing Saddles ending, but she discovered.
Yeah, what I was expecting going in, like starting the game, didn't anticipate the place we would go to is one of the characters essentially shutting down the game because she doesn't want to live in a world of pretend choice.
Right.
So, like, just philosophically, that was very interesting. And it's also, like, you can take it to various levels because, like, when you play a game like this, you don't have infinite choice. There's things that are correct. There's an author to this game. Like, there's gods in this game. The people, the devs, they've made the game. You will only progress when you do the thing they wanted you to do. There's only the 9 words you can use. There's like you like so there's only an illusion of choice in these games as it is, as there is in all games. But to find yourself in that world and say, well, this I'd rather just shut down this world. Very, very interesting. A very interesting take on that. And the whole idea that to like get out of this cycle of pretend choice, she has to basically go into the wireframe world, like go into the little section that the developers made to sort of test the game ahead of time. She goes into that to find the wireframe version of the Pillowtron and then shut it down to basically collapse the world. And so it goes into like a more 8-bit version. I found that really interesting. And it's neat that it glitches too. Like what she does is like, it's a glitch that moves her into this other thing. It's just, I found all of it really interesting in a nudge, nudge, wink, wink kind of way. And I can see how it would rub a lot of people wrong because it's one of those things where in a genre often what in a sense, wrecks the genre as we get to the point where we can no longer just enjoy it as is. We have to have comments on it. So you can't, you get to the point where you can't just have an 80s action film anymore. You have to have the last action hero. It has to be a self-aware thing. And it's sort of the tropes of the genre collapse in on themselves and nobody can see it, but ironically anymore. And so you worry that, are we at that point where you can't just have the have a game like this just be the game? We have to knowingly wink at the player and say, we all know we're actually playing a game, right? Which can, in a sense, ruin the fun. Like, you can't just have a straight-ahead action film or a straight-ahead mystery film anymore. You've got to have somebody know that they're in a mystery. But that said, I think, and I've been thinking about this a lot, that the idea of the breaking the fourth wall and a game being aware that it's a game, that was something going on in the 80s as well. It made me think of in Wasteland, one of the best games for the Apple II, there's a chunk of it where you're sort of inside a brain and that knows it's in a game and stuff, and that's really fascinating, and some happens kind of in the Ultima games a bit too. So I do think from the period this game is riffing on, it was already a thing, not a new thing in gaming or in anything. I mean, postmodern comes a lot before the 1980s. But I found the end wistful and kind of sad, because it just, she pushes in that last, like when you have to make her do it a bunch of times and the character suddenly is
And she doesn't
reticent.
Want to do it. I mean, it's like she doesn't want to do it, but she's
exactly.
She's
so you say, push the last one. And they just keep talking. You just have to do it over and over again. She's like, okay, let's go. I'm getting ready. And you just have to keep saying she'll do it. Like, push it in, push it in, push it in, which is going to basically destroy the world, kill her, what? And she gets to that point where the character clearly doesn't, maybe, or is at least reticent, like is thinking, maybe I don't want to do this. Yeah. That's a very affecting thing in a game like this.
Absolutely.
And then the fact that she pushes it and it just like, boom, cuts to black. Like, that's just, the game is over. But then, of course, there's the credits and the funny thing that comes after the credits. Well, funny, Commodore 64, boo, whatever.
That was the saddest part of the game.
They punked me, making my screen show Commodore 64. I'm like, what the heck? You're trolling me, you game, you.
Yeah. No, it's wistful and sad and kind of sweet and it was good.
Yep. Yeah. And again, I found the whole game fulfilling. The ending is one that will stick with me because I'll remember it, especially not just that she wants to shut down the game, but the one character gets the dev thing and gets to basically escape the game. Oh, and that's something I thought was a missed opportunity. So who is it? It's Agent Ray gets the puzzle dependency chart.
Yes.
Which basically gives to the dev and essentially escapes this game. So at the end of this, Dolores goes down, pushes in the 8 tubes or whatever, finally pushes in the last one, immediately cuts to black. You get the funny end credits that read past the end of file. You read past the end of the null, can't find the theme and does all this with that kind of wistful music. And then the trolling of the C64 screen, totally trolling me. I mean, really, surely these devs must know that a big chunk of their target audience probably still has very strong opinions about the old OS wars. Like, come on, man. You should have known what operating system is on and don't show me a C64. But whatever. But then the C64 does this disk recovery thing and it restarts the game. I would have found it very interesting to restart this game and have Agent Ray not be in it anymore. It should have restarted, and that character who was able to escape should not be there. And you play it again, and they would strip out the puzzles or whatever, and this world wouldn't realize there was supposed to be another character. And that would have been really interesting, but that's not what happens, and I thought it was a missed opportunity. But interesting, like very interesting end as well. And it got me, you know, thinking about it in a way that I wouldn't think a light little point-and-click adventure would. So a very, very rewarding gaming experience.
Indeed. Yeah.
Indeed.
Indeed.
So what was your, were you happy with the ending? Or did you think, oh, that's stupid or what? Because a lot of people seem not super keen on the ending.
Yeah, I was happy with the ending. Again, like that thing where I knew something was up. I was looking for the twist. But no, that moment when it just goes to black and you're just like, damn, that's damn. It, you know?
Yeah. And it doesn't fade to black. It's like she's reaching up and it's just boom, instant black. Like, in fact, a little bit quicker than I was thought going to happen. Almost like a jump, like it surprised me.
Yeah, and you know, she suicides / destroys the entire world that she has known.
As one does, right? Yeah,
right, and it's just, no. I have no problems with the ending. I am... you know, of my 16 thumbs up, definitely three of them are for the ending.
Minimum three for me as well. I thought it was funny when they're going to the wireframe world, the early version, which is super 8-bit looking, and the graphics are just nice. How when they find the wireframe Pelotron, I think she says something like, it's amazing so much evil can exist in such simple art. I'm like, oh, there's a sentence. That's like a phrase worth remembering.
Right. I liked in the wireframe world. I mean, basically the only thing to do is to explore it and look at the art, you know, and it's 15 minutes of just looking around, but you can get into many of the same places that you could see in the regular world and see what they look like in wireframe version. And
then really just look.
Yeah. All you can do is a look, but it's just a looky-loo tourism sort of thing. And you can also get into several places that you can't get into in the game. Like, you know, there's the arcade and, I don't remember now, but there's a couple of little places that you can see for the only time in wireframe world.
And that was interesting because it made me think, I wonder how much of this was, since they knew they probably scripted the whole thing out, knew they were going to do a wireframe version, and so, but we can actually use that in the future thing. So how much of it was you really seeing the quick knockoff art for what would become later? And just, I mean, just interesting in that you're so aware of the world of development that goes into this, because it talks about other LucasArts games, talks about the developers, has a character who wants to be a developer, has a character who finds a bit of it and gets to leave the game. Like, it just increasingly sort of, it's boiling the lobster, like just more and more and more until it boils over into this idea that this is a real choice and I'm going to destroy the world as one of the characters. really rewarding. I'm really glad I played it, and the ending contributes a lot to that feeling. Like, I'm really happy about the ending. I mean, it is wistful. It's not a happy ending, but it's a rewarding one for having now spent all these hours on it. At least it's something that's not as fluffy as a game like this could be.
Indeed. Yeah.
And I know fluffy.
Yeah. It's a good dog. Such a good dog.
Such a good dog. Fluffy's a good dog. That's what I got to say about that. I'm really glad I played it.
You too.
Yeah. So shall we pick... last time we picked what game we're going to play at the halfway point. But too bad. I guess that's not going to be a thing we do.
That's right. Let's pick another game. Now, I will remind you that last time you picked Sherlock, which was bad, and then I picked this game, which was good. So yeah, it's your turn.
Is it my turn? I thought this one we just did was sort of like taking a break from Infocom games. So wouldn't it still be your time to pick an Infocom game?
Sure, if you want to. I will.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, me getting what I want always seems fair. How about Starcross?
Excellent. How about that, Starcross?
How about
What's that one about?
Space.
The Final Frontier?
Something about space.
Or is it about Romeo and Juliet? I know what Starcross means.
It was an early Infocom game, one of the earlier ones.
Because you want to make sure it's an actual Infocom game.
Yes. Something in space. That's literally all I know about it. And the original box for it was really cool. It shaped like a spaceship.
So Starcross is a village with a population of 1,780 people situated on the west shore of the Exe Estuary in the county of Devon in England. So if you Google Starcross, it turns out the first result isn't about this game. I may go there and play this game.
Oh, yeah, let's do that.
That would be the best.
Nice. All right, so that's my pick.
I like it. Oh, from 1982, it is an early one. Excellent. Yeah. And I like space. I like space. Is this the one with the robots you control?
No, that's Suspended.
Okay. I really should know more about Infocom games for a guy who does an Infocom game podcast, but I'm learning as we go. I'm the color man.
Nice. Okay.
Excellent.
Are we done?
That's it. You're totally done with me. Are you kidding? Excellent. Starcross, I like it. The challenge was issued eons ago from light years away. Ooh, bring it. Bring on the space game. I want to get back to some text adventures.
Like 35 years ago was when the challenge was issued.
So the challenge was issued in 1982. Bring it on. You're playing this game in 2017. Seems right. I like it. Yeah, okay, cool. I'm much looking forward to it. Much looking forward to the return to the text adventures. Enough with this newfangled graphics nonsense and mice. I don't need any of that. I just need words. I need words and Kevin. That's all I need. And I will play games and talk to you and life will be good. Excellent. Okay, so this has been eaten by a Gru. You probably already knew that. You also might have known it's an Infocon podcast. Well, you might not have known that if this is your first episode, but it's eaten by a Gru regardless. If you want to send feedback about Infocon games or apparently other things, you can email us at Gru, that's G-R-U-E, at monsterfeet.com. You can also check us out on Twitter, which is even easier. He is at Kevin Savitz, I be at Carrington, and we will become your star-crossed lovers, I guess, if you give us a very nice review in iTunes. Oh, no, we won't kill you. StarCraft Lovers, that ends poorly. I've read that play. But please, regardless of whether or not we will poison and or stab you, go onto iTunes and give us a big five-star review. Five is our favorite number of stars. That will encourage other people to join the fun. The show notes and such can be found at monsterfeet.com. Thank you to MC Frontalot for spinning his funky Frenchness. He's not French. He's fresh. But he gave us a theme song. That's all that really matters. We appreciate it.
We
appreciate it. Oh, I'm getting punch drunk. We're having a holiday party. Kevin, thank you for podcasting with me.
Thank you for podcasting with me, Carrington.
We will be star-crossed next time. I will talk to you then.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, oh no! You have walked into the slavering fangs of a lurking Gru.
I had a nap and now I'm eating Pop-Tarts, so I'm like living the life of a 5-year-old. So I'm sad.
You and me both, baby.